Next, we have Dr. Krista Kaups from the University of California in Fresno. She's a general surgeon, trauma surgeon, critical care. She's a professor of surgery and the director of the surgical ICU. She's going to be discussing vascular access complications from the small and seemingly innocent to the big, bad, and ugly.
All right, where's my clicker? Let's see if I can make the clicker work appropriately. Good afternoon, everybody. Late afternoon on a gray and cold day. We appreciate you being here. I don't have anything to disclose. I will disclose that, as Nick said, I'm a general trauma and critical care surgeon. I am not a vascular surgeon. But I'd like to talk with you about potential complications, either ones we've created ourselves or ones that we're asked to deal with. And we all know what they are, or we know when we see them. So the things I'd like to address are central venous access, what could possibly go wrong, getting access safely, big sheaths, big balloons, and potentially big complications. So taking central venous catheters first. If we think about vascular complications, things like arterial placement or arterial injury, distal ischemia, venous injury, hematoma, and bleeding, and the delayed complications, I'm not even getting into, because this is a vascular session, I'm not even discussing the other venous access complications that will, in this talk, that could happen. So we're just going to focus on some of those vascular issues. As you are all aware, central venous catheterization is a common procedure. There's an estimated, and this is 15 years ago, but an estimated 5 million catheters are placed annually. And in a teaching hospital, they're most often placed by the less experienced members of the team. It's the interns who are working on getting their central line numbers. The estimates are that we get an arterial puncture somewhere between 4 and 9% of the time, probably less than 1% of all placements. But we all know, too, that all of these are, of course, estimates at best. We get vascular injuries several different ways. One is the simple through and through, or the shish kebab of the vein. We can have guide wire related injuries. We can have direct arterial puncture, dislodgement of arterial plaque, some of the plaque that Dr. Anton was showing us, dissection of the vessels, either the artery or the vein, and further laceration as the catheter is advanced. In fact, as you look at the potential complications, it should make you nervous. It made me nervous thinking about it. The injury may be something that's small, self-limited, that we never see, small hematoma, or something that's disastrous, particularly for the patient, but also for the surgeon. So what are the things that predict complications? Well, how many unsuccessful attempts have been made? The experience or the inexperience of the person placing the catheter, and the fact that it's an emergency situation. The patient who is critically ill or injured. We know that arterial injury is actually more likely to occur when we're placing central venous catheters in the femoral vein, more often than the subclavian vein, and we'll get into the carotid injuries in a little bit. I mentioned that I'm a trauma surgeon as part of that, and so I had to look and see what happened for trauma patients. And again, this is the indicator of the critically ill and injured patients. If you look at the upper part, the likelihood of having complications for central venous catheterization is somebody who has a high injury severity score, got intubated prior to getting to the hospital, and their odds are good of complications. Same thing for arterial catheters there. So if we're thinking about the things that can happen with arterial puncture or arterial catheter placement, when do we first, as we're working on situational awareness, what are the things that make us suspicious? Most often it's when you put in that needle and you've got a pulsatile flow. But that may be a lot more challenging to recognize in the hypotensive patient. And the person whose blood pressure is 50 may not have much pulsation happening. There are a number of times your first clue may be that the nurse is telling you that they can't get the IV bag to flow, or that the IV pump is meeting a lot of resistance. There are a number of ways to confirm that an arterial placement has occurred. The traditional one is attaching a transducer and seeing a waveform. I can't think of any circumstance where a venous catheter should have a waveform. So if there's a waveform, despite our best hopes, it's in the artery. Second thing is, kind of the traditional thing, is sending a specimen for a blood gas. Well, that's nice, but there's a couple of problems with that. It may take a little bit of time, and the problem is, in a critically ill patient, it may not give you as much information as you hope. Their blood gases may just be terrible anyway. And the other thing is the chest x-ray with an abnormal catheter position. And I would say, and we put the big arrows up to see it, is that if you get a chest x-ray for an upper torso line and you've got a catheter in an abnormal position, it's got to be explained and addressed. We know that the jugular vein does not go in that direction. You know, the SVC is not off in the right upper lung. So, and if you can see where the green arrow lies and the blue arrow lies, those are not normal positions. So you've got to explain it. You've got to deal with it too. You know, the old saying is denial does not make it go away. So to incorporate Dr. Anton's OODA loop, orient, observe, decide, and act. First of all, recognize the problem. What complication has happened? Second of all, evaluate the patient. What is going on with the patient to tell you the effects of this complication? Again, I'm talking about arterial placement. So in this circumstance, do we have an arterial placement, recognizing it? And number two, is this a serious problem or a catastrophic problem? Is the patient hypotensive? Or is their blood pressure okay? Do we need to get our resuscitation started before we run them to the operating room? Or do we have time to work this up a little bit? Is there ongoing hemorrhage? Is there distal ischemia? And management options. Okay, I've got the catheter. It's in the artery. So what do we do? Is it, let's pull it out, put it pressure, and hope for the best? Or are we going to take this patient to the operating room? I'll say that our approach will vary dependent on the clinical situation, the patient's condition. There may be some very rare circumstance when the patient's in extremis, and you can leave the catheter in for the time being. If they've got CPR in progress, leave it in, use it for access. If the patient's coagulopathic, if it's a small catheter versus a 12 French sheath, and which artery have we attacked here? Overall, the approach is to remove it as soon as we recognize it, but overall. So I'd like to specifically talk about unintentional carotid artery placement, because that really requires some specific thought. And looking at the literature, it's a little bit interesting. There was a retrospective review with 13 patients who had either carotid or subclavian artery catheterization. 5 patients had immediate removal and compression. All of them had severe complications. That didn't go well. They compared it to 8 patients who had immediate open or endovascular repair, and none of those patients had complications. The group then did a literature search and found a total of 30 patients, and the patients who had removal with compression had about a 47% major complication rate. So that gives you an idea. It's steering us in the right direction. Another review a little more recently, again, 12 patients over 11 years, 6 patients who had immediate exploration sheath removal, primary repair, also using percutaneous closure with a suture-mediated closure device. They all did quite well. No patients had complications. And in fact, when they studied them, the arteries all looked pretty good. But as you see from these series, I don't think we're ever going to see a randomized controlled trial. I think that's unlikely. And so what we have are systematic reviews of management. The largest systematic review was about 80 patients. We found no large series, probably because most of these are never reported. I would expect that many of us in this room have had experience with unintentional carotid artery placement. And in this review, they came up with 80 patients. You can see the statistics for successful treatment, at least in this group. Removal and compression was wildly unsuccessful, And this suggests to us that if you've got a catheter that ends up in the carotid artery, get it out, but either directly repair the artery or consider using endovascular methods. You may need to use a combined approach, but get people involved. Think about that. So carotid arteries are an entity unto themselves. What do we do? So some of these arterial complications. And as we look at that, again, we mentioned clinical exam for a patient. We think about IV access, blood, working on coagulopathy. What will also help us define these injuries? And so for upper torso, I talked about chest x-ray. If the patient is stable, you can think about CT angiography to find the site and the size of the injury. If it's a small injury or a large injury, you know, if the catheter is sticking someplace it doesn't belong, or if it's sitting within the vessel, lower extremity CT angiography can be helpful. I nod to my vascular surgery consultants as appropriate if that's available to you. If you've got a hybrid OR for diagnosis, endovascular and open repair, you know, both for making the diagnosis, but it depends on your situation. Again, we have to think about what we're doing. So the operative approach, the patient who's had catastrophic failure, but the operative approach is going to be determined by the location of the injury. So we think about how do you need to expose the femoral artery? How do you expose the subclavian artery or the carotid sheath? And it's basically, and I speak as a trauma surgeon here, it's the principles of addressing a vascular injury, getting adequate exposure. Trying to make an incision right around the catheter may not be your best move and just get you into a big bloody field. Getting proximal and distal control. Depending on what the injury is, either a primary repair, if it's something nice and simple that you can just put a stitch into, but you may need to think about reconstruction. For the patient who's got life-threatening hemorrhage, and these are borrowed heavily from trauma principles, you recognize that essentially, if you're trying to save the patient's life, you can essentially ligate any vein if you need to. You may have some edema, but you've got a live patient who's got edema to deal with. You can ligate a good number of significant arteries, significantly named arteries, with relatively few consequences. Recognize that there are consequences if you have to ligate the internal carotid artery, that you may be creating a situation for a stroke, creating a situation for limb ischemia if it's the external iliac, common femoral, or superficial femoral artery. But again, do what you need to do to save the patient's life, life before limb. Let's do what we can. So arterial injury is one issue. Another thing we may see from catheters is retroperitoneal hematoma, and usually it's from a femoral access site. I mean, if you can do that from a subclavian, that's really impressive. But it may be one of those things that's found incidentally, or as a CT scan is obtained to evaluate a drop in hemoglobin or hematocrit or unexplained hypotension. So first thing is to confirm that the catheter is actually in the vein and not the artery. If it's in the vein, I think you can certainly remove it, apply pressure to the site if it's appropriate. Correct coagulopathy. We see this most often in the coagulopathic patient. And I will say is that this almost never, even though it looks terrible, if there's not an arterial injury, it almost never requires operative intervention, although you may occasionally get your radiologist involved for that. But generally speaking, that's not something we're going to dive in and deal with. Other complications of thrombosis and stenosis. We see it most commonly with femoral venous catheters, but it happens with other central venous catheters. Maybe asymptomatic, or suddenly the nurse says to you, why is this patient's arm so swollen? Get the catheter out. There's no great consensus on therapeutic anticoagulation. If it's not contraindicated, we feel happier treating, so it's the clot's not propagating. And in your hypercoagulable patients, see if you can get them on therapeutic anticoagulation if there's not a contraindication. Stenosis. That is a great big unknown. Most of the time, we don't even realize that it's happening until we're trying to put in another central line, and we can't get it in, we get an ultrasound and discover that the veins are stenotic. If the patient is symptomatic, we can consider stenting. So, I've talked about venous catheterization complications. thinking about challenging patients and situations. Simple kinds of things, and we mentioned situations. The importance of positioning the patient properly. Don't ever, because I've been sucked into this before, say, oh, this is going to be an easy line, so I don't really have to put them in full positioning and do that. It's just a recipe to make your life hard. Consider the most appropriate site. For the morbidly obese patient, recruit help. You may have to have somebody who's just holding the pannus. Sterile technique, we all know that. Avoid forcing a guide wire. And sometimes this just calls for humility. If you've given it several tries, if you can find another experienced person, another pair of hands, another set of eyes, using the ultrasound. The other thing I would also throw in is using the external jugular. So what about ultrasound? I don't think you can see it from there, but this year I have my 25 plus year fellow ribbon, so I've been doing this a while. And when I started learning to do central lines, we didn't use ultrasound at all, and so we were very comfortable using landmarks. So what is the data about ultrasound? Our residents now, you know, they've got the probe out and all this, and there's certainly a role for it. And if you're comfortable, I would say get comfortable with it. I still sometimes really find it's really fiddly and I wish I had a third hand, but it can be very helpful to say, yes, that's the artery, yes, that's the vein, this is where I want to be. In the hypotensive patient, you know, finding the patient who, finding the vessel that isn't pulsating is the one that you're aiming for. If you can put color flow on it, all the better. Confirming that your needle's actually in the vessel. The data shows, the big Cochrane reviews will tell you that using ultrasound, they looked at 13 studies with 2,300 patients. The data went anywhere from very low to high quality. So for subclavian vein, they said using ultrasound, there wasn't any difference in total or other complications or numbers of attempts till success. It did reduce the risk of arterial puncture pretty significantly, reducing the risk of hematoma formation. For femoral vein, there's fewer data available. There's about 300 patients who were included. Said really it didn't make a difference in arterial puncture or complications, but you were more likely to get the catheter in the first time. And the carotid studies were all of low quality, but they thought it did decrease inadvertent arterial puncture and hematoma. Great, so these are pretty mixed studies. There were about three studies involving 450 patients where they actually looked at surgeons using ultrasound. And what they found for surgeons was that there was a faster time to placement, but no difference in complications overall. So again, I think like anything else, it's a tool that can be helpful. Last part I'd like to talk about is balloons and sheaths and, you know, things that go bump in the night. Interventional catastrophes. And one of the things that we've been using more frequently, and the etiologies for balloons and sheaths, you know, it's the interventional radiologists, it's our friendly cardiologists, and oh, by now, it's your friendly trauma surgeons and ED physicians who are using REBOA catheter placement. If you're not familiar, REBOA, it's kind of a cute acronym, stands for Resuscitative Endovascular Balloon Occlusion of the Aorta. It's an internal way of doing an ED thoracotomy. Femoral artery access with sheath placement, balloon catheter that gets filled with saline that for abdominal hemorrhage gets inflated in the aorta in aortic zone 1, for pelvic hemorrhage in aortic zone 3. We most often place these in the ED, and most often it's the trauma surgeon, but the ED physicians have gotten busily and actively involved in this as well. Originally, it was 12 to 14 French sheaths that were placed via cut down. It was switched to a percutaneous approach, but it required open removal with repair or closure device. The sheaths are now 7 French. They're intended for percutaneous placement and then removal with direct pressure. The thing of note is that more and more people are using REBOA catheters, the obstetrical hemorrhage, GI bleeds, etc. Thing to think about, we wonder about vascular complications. Whoops, where am I going with this? So the catch is for REBOA catheters, the mortality is high because again, we think about this as something that we're using instead or in conjunction with ED thoracotomy. If you remember, and I think many in this room do, mortality for ED thoracotomy was always greater than what was described in the literature. And, you know, we've had survivors, but it's high. So mortality in this group of patients is 60%. That has nothing to do with catheter complications. These are hypotensive, critically ill patients. Catheter-related complications that have been described are aortic injuries, iliac and femoral artery injuries, embolization, peripheral ischemia, and the incidence is basically unknown, although we do see one meta-analysis that looked at 13 patients, three-fourths of them had percutaneous access. They claimed a 6% complication rate for related to groin access with limb loss of about 2%. That's terrific. We have a suspicion it may be a little bit higher than that. But again, really sick patients, we're going to be seeing more complications related to that. And then finally, we talk about vascular complications from our radiologists and cardiologists. Vascular complications, half to 2%, thrombosis, embolism, hematoma. The importance of having a good vascular exam prior to the procedure. Exam and workup based on symptoms and diagnosis. The catastrophes are the same. It's the hematoma, it's the hemorrhage. Evaluating the patient, resuscitating the patient, and going from there. So finally, I'd just like to say, as I talk about central venous access as a common procedure, never assume that this one will be easy. Understand some of the pitfalls and think about what you need to do to address them. Practice using the ultrasound. We all need all the help we can get. Especially for carotid artery misplacement, recognize it, address it, don't just put pressure and hope for the best. And then we also have to realize that life-saving interventions may have their own life-threatening complications. Thank you.